Hello there. You're very welcome to Burning Books. My name's Ruth McKee and I'm the editor of Books Ireland. With me today, I have author and podcaster Sophie White. Her latest book is called Where I End and it's out now with Tramp Press. Sophie, lovely to talk to you today and thanks for coming on. I wanted to start by asking you what kind of a reader you were as a young girl, you know, what it was like in your house, if there were books about, you know, what that experience was like for you, and maybe if there's a book from that time that you'd save if your house was on fire.
Sure. I definitely grew up in a house full of books and loved reading when I was a kid. I suppose I kind of can't remember the really sort of young stuff, but I think the first kind of books that I really like glommed onto were like the Goosebumps series, which is by an American writer called R.L. Stein. And it's a massive series. I think there's like about 40 books in that series. They were horror for kids, you know, so the grown-ups in the stories were always, you know, too stupid to really know what was going on in the town. And the kids were kind of like, you know, trying to save the day from like monsters or like haunted. One of the ones that really stuck with me was the haunted ventriloquist dummy one, which is iconic. And I just loved, I mean, it definitely laid the foundations for like my love of horror. I suppose they were a bit like almost the like Enid Blyton for my generation in that they were always the kids kind of like exactly saving the day and on adventures and like very much, you know, more knowing than the adults. And they had these great covers. I don't know if you remember them. They were like kind of like really bright kind of green with like there'd be like slime kind of coming down the cover or like really scary picture or, you know, so they obviously captured me completely and I was obsessed with them. And yeah, I remember the library a lot from when I was a kid. Like I loved the library and I couldn't get over the fact that you were allowed to just take books. Like what? And like to this day, I love the library. I work in the library a lot. Like just still find it such an exciting place to go into. There's just, I think there's always just this sense of kind of like boundless possibility in a library, you know?
I was going to just stop you there because we were talking about horror and like that, the kind of early experience. What draws kids in particular, I think, to like, you know, later on in childhood, sort of when you're kind of crossing that threshold a bit, you know, like those peculiar years, what is it that kind of draws kids to those kind of books, to like real, you know, real darkness and, you know, that kind of.
I suppose like maybe it's sort of, a way of putting like a kind of a form and structure on the kind of like fears of childhood that are kind of, I think like being afraid as a child is such a scary sort of state because you don't really, you can't really articulate it to yourself so often, you know, if you have bad dreams and stuff like that, they're so frightening. Like I think the nightmares of our childhood often stay with us in a way that adulthood nightmares never do. Yeah. And like, maybe it's sort of a great way to put order to the scary things in the world. If they're like in a book and a monster embodies the fear, and then that kind of monster can be, you know, vanquished or, you know, dealt with in some way. Like maybe it's something to do with that. But then also, I just think it's also that kind of thing of like the forbidden. Yeah. Like I feel like we gravitate towards the thing that's like, you know, off limits. And it's not like, you know, it's not like my parents were like keeping Goosebumps off limits because it's a fairly innocent enough stuff, but some of it is really scary. And you know, I guess it's just that kind of like transgressive thing always really appeals to us, or certainly appeals to a certain type of kid.
Yeah, well, that's it. Yeah. It's a certain type, because I'm thinking, you know, there are some people who would be reading Narnia at that stage, you know, or you know, in a different kind of sense, maybe approaching it. But like you mentioned here, Carrie by Stephen King, I wanted to ask you what age you were when you first read it.
I think I was about 12 when I read Carrie.
Oh my God.
And it was really formative.
Like, that's great. Like, that's pretty graphic. Yeah.
It's scary. And like, I read The Exorcist like not long after as well. And the reason I can remember so vividly kind of like what age I was because I remember like I was just starting secondary school.
Yeah.
And I remember like I used to always read under the table in class. And yeah, like I think Carrie like just came at the exact point in my life. Like I was the same age virtually as Carrie. And like, I was, you know, so much of Carrie is like, you know, set in a high school. And well, it's actually what I loved so much about Carrie is it really opened my eyes up in terms of like what a book can be, because Carrie is kind of like a sort of bit of a sort of meta fiction. There's a word for it actually. It's called epistolary, which is an epistolary novel. I think I'm saying that right. Basically, it's made up of letters and reports of events, and so it's kind of an almost like it's outsiders documenting the events, which gave it such a kind of like ring of truth, you know. Yeah. And like underscored the horror of what takes place in the book just so much more. And I think I just got really excited by literally the language and the use of this narrative device, like really opened my eyes up in terms of like what a book can be. And then obviously it's just such a great story. And like just being the exact age, like coming of age, kind of like hitting puberty, feeling like such an outsider. And like Carrie is like mercilessly bullied in the book. And like, I think that no matter like how much experience of bullying you might have, like even if it's only a small degree, and anyone's bullying experience is probably small compared with Carrie's, but you know, you can't but identify with it. And like, definitely as like a young teenage girl, like I just, you know, I just so identified with like feeling so out of it and feeling like people hate you, or you know.
Yeah.
So I was young when I got my hands on it. I don't remember, like, I think I had gotten it from the library, I'm pretty sure.
Can you imagine them just handing you out that book as well? I'm just imagining if that happened today, like, you know, when you just sort of waltzed up, like, yep, I'm taking The Shining, I'm taking Carrie.
I know.
I'm taking Rivers of Blood. Yeah.
I mean, I definitely found Carrie to be like not as scary a read as, say, The Exorcist. I think The Exorcist scared me way more. But I just loved them. I feel like horror, like, really has the power to move you as a reader, like in just this really visceral way.
Can I, this is probably one of those questions, but like, where's the, you know, between thriller and horror, what, like, where does it tip? You know, or how would you sort of differentiate?
To me, thrillers obey a certain order in their stories. I find thrillers tend to wrap things up, for example, in like quite neat ways. Like, I love thrillers. I do love reading thrillers. Like, and I always am really fascinated by the construction of the thriller from a plot point of view. Like, I just think that thriller authors, oh my God, like they can plot like nobody, you know. And but I do find that like thrillers, they conform more to kind of the rules of life, and you know, they're a bit more they're a bit more accessible, they're a bit more kind of like packaged,
and there's a contract nearly between you and the like between them and the reader. It's like, you know what to expect. Yeah,
that is exactly the right phrase. Yes, it's like a kind of expectation there that this will resolve itself, that we will understand what's wrong in the novel, what's going on. It'll become clear. And whereas horror, I think, is just so much more ambiguous. I think as well with a thriller, you know that you're signing up to maybe a level of scariness and violence, but like they tend to stay on a certain side of a line, whereas with horror I feel like all bets are off. You know, and so that's kind of my like way I differentiate them.
And is
you know, and I love them both,
that kind of chaos, not chaos, but that kind of, there's that sort of throbbing vein of uncertainty, or like you're not stable in that world.
Absolutely, yeah.
For me as a reader, I would shy away from horror now, not when I was younger. And that's the interesting thing. Same with films. So that's why I'm curious as to how we're sort of almost braver or more open to that when we're younger. Well, speaking personally, and then, you know, post having children and everything else, you know, horror just like, you know, I don't need anything to tap into that terror. Yeah. You know,
like you don't need any additional stress.
Like,
I know.
But do you find it as a writer? Sorry, I'm going off topic here, but do you find it sort of disconcerting or unsettling as a person or as a writer to kind of go in there now, you know, to kind of seek out that source of it, you know, when you're writing?
Honestly, I don't know what this says about me, that I find it so enjoyable. Like maybe it's because there's an element of desensitization. Like I find much tougher. I find things like, you know, stories about like, you know, children or illness, things like that are like the kind of new horror. I love really grim, gory horror.
Right.
And I love like speculative fiction type horror.
Yes.
I'm thinking of one actually that came out quite recently called Tender is the Flesh. Mm. I don't know if you heard of it. It's a South American author, as far as I remember. And it's basically kind of speculative fiction about how like kind of in the near future, a kind of a pandemic among the animals has spread, and all the animals in the world have this disease that means that humans can't eat them anymore. And so they start like essentially like breeding and farming
humans
to be food.
Fantastic. Actually, that concept. Yeah, that's like so exciting.
Yeah, exactly. And it's an amazing novel. It's so good. And then, so I find that like, I love that. And then say Maggie O'Farrell's Hamnet, I found so tough that I had to put it away. Because the opening of that book is about an ill child, and so that's where horror lies for me now. And I almost feel like horror as a genre for a reader and as a writer is a place that I can go and actually have some really, really grim, morbid fun. You know, so when I was working on my last novel, Where I End, which is kind of a literary fiction horror, oh my God, I used to just revel in like how to delight and repel my reader now, you know? And it's so fun because that contract doesn't exist anymore. Because say like the other type of novels I write are like kind of rom-coms, kind of like chick lit, and there's a contract there too, very much so, that you are, you know, you're going to entertain, you're going to provide, I like to provide a bit of escapism, you know, like I really want to write entertaining romps, you know, there's no room for gore in that world, you know, whereas in horror there is no holds barred and I revel in it.
Imagining the two of those worlds colliding would be kind of interesting.
I know, and the thing is I work on them concurrently, so I will have, you know, just the grimmest of the grim on one draft, and then I'll be popping over to the other draft, which is like comedy, you know?
Yeah.
And the different, like, you know, the research and things like that went into Where I End was so fun, but like, it was very hard on the stomach. Like, when I'm writing first drafts, I have quite a like specific routine. I tend to write between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. Just when I'm in a first draft mode,
yeah.
and I kind of write to a word count, that kind of helps me kind of get all the ideas down and onto the page to then work with when I'm doing the second draft or whatever. And so I'd often be like there, either like I often write in bed or my desk is in the corner of the room, and like I'd be there having not even eaten breakfast yet. So I'd be like on an empty stomach, looking up, you know, images of bodies that have been in the water for several days.
Oh,
and I'd just be delighted with myself. And then like I text my editor and like I used to update them on what disgusting search results I was looking at today, you know. So it's I think the thing with why we like horror so much more when we're younger is like, A, if you're pretty lucky and privileged, life hasn't had its way with you yet in a massive way. I mean, that's if you're on the very lucky end of things. And then also the other thing I think is that young people, just by instinct, I think we seek out extreme experiences. Now, yeah, maybe there are people who were more cautious when they were younger. I certainly wasn't. I was the complete opposite. And like when I was a teenager, you know, I wanted, you know, to, you know, do drugs and drink and find all of the, you know, most extreme experiences was what attracted me, you know?
Yeah.
And it's only like growing up that I copped on, you know, which I think loads of people relate to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, so I think that's where horror kind of fits for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I love horror films. Oh my God. Like at Christmas, I always have a tradition of doing a horror marathon. And my husband does not like horror films. Sometimes I can get him along for some of the more kind of prestige horror, you know, that's coming out now, like Get Out,
right.
And Nope.
I'm kind of with your husband here. I'm totally with him.
Full scale scary. He won't do. Like we're watching The Last of Us at the moment,
right.
Which is stunningly good American series. I don't know if you've caught up with it yet.
It's not so good.
It's zombies. It's set in kind of a post-apocalyptic world.
Is it a little bit like The Road? No, it's not like The Road and that.
Yeah, it's no.
That was amazing.
It's very much like The Road setup as well. Like the kind of protagonists are a man and a very young girl that he's trying to take to safety. Seb is watching, but he has a special little pillow for hiding.
Yes.
Like it really creeps him out. The zombies in it are brilliant, but the actual emotional heft of the series is incredible. Like it's really good. It reminds me of The Leftovers in terms of the psychology of being left over after something cataclysmic that has changed the fabric of society. And there's so much to explore within that. And I think that's what The Last of Us is doing really well as well. Like some episodes, there's hardly any zombies in them. And it's all about like, how do you make a life against the backdrop of hell, of a nightmare. Very like Station 11 as well, you know.
So again, that's much more, to me, that's more speculative and, you know, that side of things rather than the kind of, you know, the grotesque. But The Leftovers for me was... It was so sinister by the end. Like there was a real sense of malevolence and evil in it that really, really disturbed. I had terrible dreams watching that. So it doesn't get into your psyche, into your nightmares or anything like that. Not too much.
I'm very steeped in it all because I do this podcast called The Creep Dive, and it's a storytelling podcast and it's kind of comedy, but we tell really grim stories on the podcast. And, you know, we don't limit ourselves to grimness, you know, we kind of will cover anything from survival stories and conspiracy stories and catfishing to, you know, serial killers or whatever, but we do like to mix it up and we don't like to totally just, you know, focus on say murder and things like that. Like if there's a lot of podcasts that are just true crime, you know, we're not that. We definitely seek out just like weirder things, and they don't necessarily have to be really cruel and, you know, grim things. But I suppose it's like, you know, just, I never lost the morbid fascination, you know?
So you were saying, like, around your teeny, well, you were saying you were around 12, sort of 13 when you read Carrie, and there was Stephen King and that kind of thing going on. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned, like, as you were going through your teenage years, that it was kind of, well, you know, it's always going to be difficult for people, but you were having a reasonably tough time. And there was a book around that period that you'd hang on to now if you had to see it from that period.
Well, I think I put Marion Keyes on that shelf, did I?
You did.
Or is it something different?
This is Are You Somebody?
Yes. Sorry. Yes. I read Are You Somebody when I was about 15.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was such an important book for me. I just come back to it all the time as being really formative. So this is by Nulo Fuelon, and it was her memoir, or as she called it, her accidental memoir. It just, again, was another one of these books that kind of just showed me what books can be.
Yeah.
And I think there is that thing where, like, you get introduced to books and there is the kind of chore of learning to read. And then, you know, as you move through into the world of books, you know, your whole concept of what they are completely changes, and you suddenly are like, oh, these are supposed to be fun and these are fun, and they're also, you know, going to make you feel less alone. And that's what Are You Somebody really did for me. I think, like, you know, the biggest thing, well, there's kind of two really big things that Nulo Fuelon did with that book that really, really hit home to me. And one was that she, you know, didn't strive to be likable, and she simply strove to be candid and honest and herself with that book. And it was the bravest thing I could conceive of. You know, as a teenager, where you're kind of constantly compartmentalizing and trying to hide your vulnerable self, you know, like, that's such a kind of crazy, sustained sort of performance that we'd put on as teenagers, just to hide ourselves for fear of, you know, being ridiculed and mocked and ostracized. And so that was, like, the first time I'd ever really witnessed a woman telling her story with complete just courage and matter of factness. Like, she, you know, occupied her position completely unapologetically and just, you know, was so truthful about her family, so truthful about where her upbringing brought her. And then, you know, like, I don't really know, it's not for me to say whether Nulo Fuelon was bisexual, but she did detail affairs with men and with a woman. And that was huge for me, even though, like, it took years for me to kind of really come round to my own sexuality. And I think, you know, I still feel sad that I, you know, that I still grappled so long. Do you know what I mean? But I think that's kind of what happens. And I think maybe it's not like, oh, bisexuals have it specifically hard at all. And in so many ways, we don't, because obviously you can be in a straight relationship, and in so many ways you can, like, quote unquote, pass and avoid questions, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I think it was something that was way less visible when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
And it felt very, like, very difficult to kind of be honest with myself and understand myself. And so Are You Somebody was, like, really, really big for me, you know?
Yeah.
In that respect. And I really appreciated that enormously.
It sounds like there were a couple of books that were at particular junctures in your life, and difficult times, and also monumental times. And I'm thinking, like, in Who was it said about one of your, if men had babies, there's something about pregnancy being the true horror, like a truly horrific kind of concept in itself, and that you write about the kind of the horror of that. I'm using the word horror very loosely here. But when you had your own baby, when you were pregnant for the first time and you're having your own baby, I'm kind of curious as to what that experience was like for you. And you mentioned a book I wish I'd read anything other than What to Expect, the awful, awful book. just honestly, I think I wish I'd burned it. Anyway, so you say that you read Anne Enright's Making Babies when you had your first
yes
baby.
Yes, I did. And it was a fantastic book. And it's absolutely not just for people who are making babies. It's such a brilliant, brilliant book about just about personhood, really. And obviously a lot about being an artist and a mother, I think, or an artist and a parent. You know, and it's again just like Nuala Whelan's book, it's just you know, a woman standing in her space and, you know, just being you know, completely, I mean, matter of fact about, I don't want to say unlikability, because I love Anne Enright and Nuala Whelan, and, you know, but I suppose just, you know, just a willingness to, you know, just step outside of the social contract, you know. And, you know, Anne Enright, I think what was really, really brave with Anne Enright's book was her willingness to be ambivalent about, you know, the prospect of becoming a mother, you know, when she first finds out she's pregnant and things like that. And like, that was really huge for me, because, you know, my first pregnancy, it wasn't entirely planned. And, you know, I was really like scared, like really scared. And, you know, it was very comforting to read Making Babies and see that it's an experience it's so universal on so many levels, but also it's so, so singular and so personal to each person, you know. And especially, like, I think it's so much better now, but I think the kind of narrative, you know, that I was exposed to, say it's 10 years ago, was so much more the kind of, you know, glowing mother and, you know, the total bullshit, like the nonsense posts on Instagram. I actually wasn't on Instagram back then, but if I was, I'm sure it would have been hellish seeing all of these women purporting to adore motherhood, just kind of unreservedly adore it with, you know, no acknowledgement of what a complete, you know, upheaval it is. You know, it's crossing the Rubicon, and it's, or, you know, my husband had a great way of describing becoming a parent. He said it's like going through a door and then into a room and then turning around and the door you just came in has disappeared and it's just a brick wall. I know, that's such a brilliant way of putting it. Like, just that kind of sense of being unmoored in this total abyss and the terrible pressure that's put upon women, I think, very particularly, to be happy all the time being a mother. And like, it's, and I mean, it's another book I didn't put down, but Rachel Cusk's A Life's Work.
Yes.
Also a book that I've read since becoming a mother that I absolutely loved and like have read with great interest, the just absolute vitriol that was poured on her when that book came out in the early 2000s. And, you know, again, it was just a woman like standing in her space and, you know, just being like, just being honest about it, you know.
There's so much more now that I wish had been around when I had, you know, was pregnant and had babies. And you've got Alice Kinsella's book coming out, Milk, and Jessica Traynor's Pit Lullabies, you know, both absolutely beautiful celebration of everything there, but also pretty, you know, just honest. Would it be great, absolutely great to have that kind of stuff around, you know, just to feel, oh yeah, me too.
Like, I think that both of those books, like Alice Kinsella's book is out next month, and like I was lucky enough to read a advanced copy, and I think that it shares with Pitt Lullabies this kind of this way that when you first become a mother, you are removed from time as everyone else experiences it, and just how like that dislocation like really messes with your head and is really frightening. And I think both of those kind of like in just in these really beautiful ways kind of represent that and put like articulate it in this way that if I'd read it when I had my first baby would have made me just feel so much more normal.
Yes.
Because that's it. I think you spend the whole of your first go round feeling like completely abnormal. Yes. And abhorrent for very basic, you know, feelings of not loving this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You don't even have to go all the way over into hating it. Yeah, for you to, yeah, feel really bad. You know what I mean? So it's mad, but it's yeah, it's really great that work now is speaking to that experience.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Marion Keyes earlier, and I want to just hop back to her very quickly because books that make you laugh, I've said it before on the podcast, I have a little separate list that I make of books that make you laugh.
The ones I come back to a lot is I think I have reread Rachel Holiday, The Break, and Grown Ups the most. Watermelon, obviously, is her first and was my first, Marion Keyes. And I read that when I was a teenager. And, you know, I had, you know, my granny and my mother both adored it, and then I joined them in that, you know. So, and I do think that's like illustrative of Marion Keyes's amazing powers, is there's three generations of women who adore this book, and you know what I mean, like I, yeah, think that's one of her incredible gifts, like along with everything else, along with her huge empathy, her humor, you know. God, the characters that she's created, like, yeah, you know, like I just feel very like I'm on first name basis with all of them kind of thing, you know, that kind of way. Like, yeah, Amy in The Break is just such a vivid woman to me. And like, yeah, I've reread a lot of Marion Keyes. I also like, I feel like I read Marion Keyes a lot when I'm working on my kind of chick lit side of my work, my commercial fiction side. I know lots of people who had been kind of under the lash of chick lit, like writers who had been labeled as chick lit, probably don't like the phrase. I feel like I'm taking it back.
Yeah.
I'm reclaiming it because I like thinking of mine as that. But sure, look, I often read Marion Keyes as like a kind of to seek out, kind of to be schooled in writing, you know, like I find there's so much to learn from how she constructs her novels and how she, you know, just brings us in, and so much so that the characters feel like our friends and they feel like, yeah, our family. And so, yeah, I just absolutely love her, you know.
Yeah, queen. We've flown off the tangent. I can't even speak. We've flown off the tangent. I'm just coining that as a phrase. I haven't been drinking. It's 11 in the morning. I was going to say to you, yeah, we've gone right off tangent. So I'm going to jump to the end and ask you about something that isn't a book that you would save from your house if it was on fire. And not, and we can't have animals either because they're our family. So something that's not one of your pets or an animal friend or a book, what would you save?
Or a human.
A human, of course.
Just an object. Yeah. I think my current knitting project, whatever that might be at any given time. I knit all the time. I always have a project on the go, just like, you know, the way you'd always have a book you're reading. I always have something I'm knitting as well. And I suppose it would just be a tragedy to lose something midway through this, you know, mid knit. Exactly. And, you know, I find I took up knitting like, 5 years ago, actually, because I took it up when I first got sober. And it was such an amazing tool for grounding me. I do 12-step meetings. So I found it a really amazing way to keep my head still enough to listen and learn in the meetings. It would just be something meditative that I could do that helped me stay present. You know, I just associate it with a kind of being on a journey to recover, you know, and it reminds me of, I would knit when I'm writing a lot, like often kind of if I'm reading through something that I've been working on, or if I'm trying to kind of like, you know, untangle something plot wise, or, you know, if I'm just kind of at an impasse, even like I'll pick up the needles. And, you know, I don't even mostly have to think about it. Like sometimes if I'm knitting a more complicated project, you know, that's kind of different. But I, you know, I try and keep it fairly simple so that I can kind of think while I do it.
Yeah, it takes the kind of racy part of your brain and just kind of settles it down.
Exactly.
Like the engine of it can just kind of idle away and do that while you're, I can totally understand that. Totally understand that.
Absolutely.
Before you go, I want you to tell us what you're working on now, because one of the questions that we didn't get around to was, you know, what you would save of your own work that, but what are, and writers always say it, it's always the thing that's new. It's always your new love, that, you know, your pearl books just get, you know, never mind them, I'm on my new thing. So what is your current love then? What are you working on?
I suppose the reason I chose to save my current work in progress is because I just would assume that there's plenty of copies of my books out in the world, whereas this one has not been printed yet. So I'm working on, my new novel is called My Hot Friend. Ooh. And it is kind of a rom-com, except the relationships are platonic. It's like a platonic rom-com. So it's about three women who have, for very different reasons, all kind of broken up with their best friends and need new friends.
Uh-huh. Oh, I love this.
But there's kind of complications, of course. So one of them is called Lexi, and she has a podcast with her like lifelong best friend. And their podcast is kind of like freewheeling sort of gals chatting. And it's really successful. So they've kind of monetized their best friendship, and with terrible results. And then one of them has just had a baby, and she's the first of her friends to have a baby, and none of them have any clue what her life is like now. And she is very lonely, and also like is going through that stage post baby where your partner like cannot do anything right. It's just because you need to lash out at someone and they just happen to be the closest person, but she's very much like locked in that and desperate for a friend who understands. And then the other one is Claire, who basically is kind of paranoid. She's losing touch with her like lifelong friends. And then her best friend gets engaged and she's passed over for the bridesmaid's duties. And things sort of spiral, escalate. So, I mean, I just feel like there's such a social script for, you know, breaking up with your boyfriend or girlfriend. And I think like I'm just seeing it more and more as I'm getting older, like how much like people struggle in their friendship relationships and how it's not given the sort of the space and the airtime as romantic relationships.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I've definitely like, I mean, it was, you know, even a few years ago, I wrote an article about breaking up with friends, and I put it out to social media to try and talk to people who were, you know, recovering from a friendship breakup. And like, there was just such a huge response to the piece. I just felt, oh, there's something in this, you know, there's definitely something people are craving talking about this. And especially like, you know, we talk a lot about how hard it is to make friends as an adult, you know, like I lived abroad, for most of my 20s, and I moved back in 2012. And I remember like all of my friends had not moved on, but they had new friends that they'd made at work, or, you know, things like that. And I was like I had those friends, but like I had moved away from where I was living. They lived in another country there. So I remember this real kind of sense of like very deliberately having to go out and like find new friends, you know, and how difficult that is as a 30-year-old, especially someone who, like, I didn't go into a job in an office or anything like that, you know. So, and that's it. I just feel like as well, there's this thing when I'm fighting with a friend, like it's so much harder and more upsetting than when I'm fighting with my other half, you know.
That's true. That's very true. And it kind of, I know that feeling well. And it kind of hangs around in your stomach, and it's, the world isn't right until it's sorted out.
Oh, completely that. Completely that. And so, yeah, so that's my hot friend.
And great.
So I'm in the final stages with it. I mean, just literally, you know, I'll be reading the typeset proof this coming week.
So are we talking publication next year or this year, Sophie?
It's out in May.
It's out in May, so we're that close. Okay,
fantastic. I know, yeah. We're down to the wire.
Wow.
It'll be fine.
Okay.
Will it? Can touch wood, touching all the wood.
Are we allowed to ask who that's out with then in May? My hot friend?
Yeah, of course, Hachette.
Hachette,
yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, no, I absolutely love working with Hachette. There, I love my editor so much. I feel sorry for her and I love her, you know, like, because I send her these drafts and like I'm there like I don't even know what it is anymore, and then Kira just like rescues me, and she also just is so creative and like just has such vision, and, you know, just always knows just the thing, you know. And and she also named my hot friend, and I love the name. It had a worse name before.
Oh, go on. go on.
The original name was The Revenge Ship. So it was like, you know, kind of making a friend in revenge.
I actually quite like that as a term, though. That's a good one. A revenge
ship. It's a good term. Yeah, but My Hot Friend, I just love the name.
My Hot Friend is definitely better. Okay, well, listen, best of luck with the book, and we'll look out for it in May. And thank you for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you, Ruth.
I've been talking with the lovely Sophie White, whose book, Where I End, is out now with Tramp Press. See you all next time.